Hi everybody, my name is Bill and I am an alcoholic. And the very first thing I want to do, and to do with total sincerity and earnestness, is to thank whoever is responsible. And I never know who the people are in the background. Whoever is responsible for having me standing right here, right now, doing what I'm proposing to do. Whoever has brought this about, I want to say to them, thank you from the bottom of my heart. You've already been given an indication of the job I'm in, and the number of times when it's possible for me to be in this company on a Sunday morning is very, very few. And I consider myself a lucky guy to be able to be with you right now. And there's someone else I want to thank very specially. Whoever put together the map for getting here. That's a very important person in my life. I am a total genius at getting lost. Anytime I have ever come to do a job like this, I have always gotten lost first. This time, I came straight here without one bit of trouble. It worked. That does not always happen for me. I was back home in Ireland. By the way, you've gathered where I come from already. The last time I was back home in Ireland, I was given the use of a car. And I was in my the capital city of my little country. It was called Dublin. And I used to know Dublin a long, long time ago. But it's all changed now, and it's got all one-way streets in the middle of downtown. Anyway, I was trying to get to a certain street, and every time I came anywhere near it, the arrows were all pointing away. So I got totally frustrated, and I eventually pulled into the curb, and I was wearing my regimentals, you know, with the collar back to front and all that good stuff. And one of the natives was passing along, and I put the window down, and I said, "Hey, Pat, how do you get to Thomas Street?" So he looked up the street and he looked down the street and he said, "Ah, Father," he said, "to get to Thomas Street, you wouldn't really start from here at all." I knew I was home. There was a story going the rounds when I was back there about a guy from Texas who was on a vacation over there, and he got in with this Irish farmer, and he asked the farmer to show him around his farm. So the Irish farmer did, and when the Texan saw it, he said, "You know," he said, "back on my farm, back in Texas, we call it a ranch. If I got up at sunrise and got into my car to go around my farm, by the time the sun would have set, I wouldn't have gotten halfway around." And the Irish farmer looked at him and he said, "Geez," said, "is that so? You know," he said, "I had a car like that once too." Now that's the kind of people we are in the country that has real alcoholics. That's the difference between an Irish alcoholic and any other kind of an alcoholic. All of you, when you became alcoholics, became bullshitters. We don't have to wait. We're to the manor born. Anyway, that's where I was born a long time ago. Now, every time I tell my story, I'm looking back at my life from the vantage point I have now after being with you for a fair number of years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I look back from this vantage point, I see myself in a totally different light from the way I used to see myself when I was back there. I want to tell you, the very first meeting I went to of AA was down in San Diego. And I saw, for the first time in my life, the 12 steps that were up there on the wall. And when I was looking at those 12 steps, for some reason I don't understand to this day, I realized that I was in the presence of something that was what I needed for a long time. I realized that if ever there was anyone who needed to do exactly what those 12 steps said to do, it was me. I needed to do that. Now, how I knew that, I don't know. But I zeroed in on the second step. You know, the one... right now. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And when I was looking at that, I said, good Lord, all the people in this outfit of AA were all nuts. They had to be restored. And when I was looking at it, I said to myself, my God, maybe that's what's been wrong with me all the time. If it was, it would explain a lot. And when I look back now at my life that I'm going to tell you about, I know now that I was nuts. I really was. I was nuts, not merely after I started drinking. I was born nuts. That's my own personal belief. I really, when I tell you my story, I'm going to be telling you about someone who was nuts. Now, it may all appear perfectly normal to you. I don't know. But I have to tell you, that's the way I see it now. And there are different kinds of nuts, you know. There are different kinds of nuts. And the particular kind of nut that I believe I was a religious nut. Yeah. Yeah. Now, whether I still am, I don't know. I really don't know. So, anyway, here's the way it was. I was born in a little village where in the south of Ireland, by the way, not in that mad place up north, no. In the south of Ireland, where everybody was a Roman Catholic, where the center of life was the church in the middle of the village, that's where everything affected the whole of life. And when I was a little kid, I was raised up the way all the little kids were. I went to the school, first of all, that was run by the nuns. Then I went to the school that was run by the religious brothers. Then I went to the school, the classical school, they call it, and the people who taught there were all clergy. And so, as you can imagine, I heard about God an awful lot. An awful lot. Now, you know the job I'm in now. I'm a Roman Catholic priest. And I don't ever remember deciding to become a priest. I don't ever remember making that decision. As far as I was concerned, it was what I wanted from as far back as I can remember. Nobody ever suggested it to me. And as I was growing up, if you had asked me now, why is that what you want to be? Why? I would have been a bit embarrassed to tell you, because it would have meant telling you about feelings I had inside me. But as I tell you, I don't know when I look back now whether they were normal or abnormal. Anyway, I'll tell you what they were. I always wanted what I said. because I had certain ideas from as far back as I can remember. Now, I want to remind you that if someone is nuts, what they are told and what they hear isn't always the same thing. So I want you to allow for that now when I tell you. I got the idea that the biggest thing a human being could do with their life, what do you think that is? The biggest thing a human being can do. What does the ultimate in human success or achievement consist in? I would have given you an answer to that when I was a kid. To me, way back then, the biggest thing a human being could do is to love God perfectly, period. Do that, you've done the biggest thing a human being can do. Bigger than getting to the moon and back, bigger than finding the cure for cancer, bigger than making the million or the billion. I had gotten this idea from way, way back. They told me that the good book says, what is the greatest and the first of all the commandments, of all the real values? And the answer was, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole heart, thy whole soul, thy whole mind. Do that, you've done the biggest of all. And if someone said to me, well, what exactly, though, do you have to do in order to do that? What do you have to do in order to love God perfectly? I would have said, well, you know, the very first thing you have to do is you have to make yourself as miserable as you can possibly make yourself. That's the first thing. You got to deny yourself. You got to give up all kinds of things. You got to afflict yourself. And so I said to my little self, okay, if that's what you have to do, that's fine and dandy by me. That's what we'll do. And then I got the idea. Now, don't forget, what I heard and what I was told mightn't have been the same thing. I don't know. But then I got the idea later on, if you really want to go in for an honors course in doing this business of loving God perfectly, you want to go in for an honors course in doing this, what you have to do is, you got to leave home, you got to leave your family, your possessions, and you got to go way out foreign to convert the heathen. And I said to my little sister, and where could you get more heathen than England? So that's what I decided to do. At the ripe old age of 15, I packed my little bag. I stood on my little flat feet in front of my mother and father and said, I'm going to England. And my father brought me along to the little ship that went across the Irish Sea from Dublin across to a place called Liverpool in the north of England. And I went from there to a prep school run by monks, people who live in a monastery. And after a number of years of being a boarder in that prep school, I entered the monastery to become a monk. And I became a monk. And in the course of being a monk, I also was ordained a priest. And I lived in that monastery as a monk for 30 years. Now, I know you'd be very curious to know probably what life is like living in a monastery as a monk. It was a hard life, it was severe, but it was a very happy life. It was what I wanted. We used to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And when I say get up, I don't mean we got up out of the bed that you understand by a bed. There were just two trestles with boards on it and a straw mattress and a straw pillow. And you got up out of that at 2 o'clock in the morning. and you tootled along to what was called the Abbey Church to sing the praises of God. Now, what God wanted his praises sung for at 2 o'clock in the morning don't forget what I told you. It seemed quite a good idea to me then. It was a life where you denied yourself in all kinds of ways. We fasted 3 days a week. We worked in the fields. We took 3 vows, a vow of poverty so that you never owned anything to call your own, no money to call it, no money, no possessions, property, anything like that. Everything was in common. You took a vow of obedience. You undertook to regard the will of the superior as the will of God himself. And you took a vow of what's called chastity, in order to renounce all that has to do with romance and sex and marriage and all that lovely stuff. By the way, the whole purpose of all this was to do what that third chapter of ours talks about. You know, it talks about ego has to be smashed. Well, that's all that all that stuff was all about. Smashing ego, apparently, is what you have to do if you get close to God and have God get close to you and have him run your life instead of running it yourself. That's all it was really all about. And I want to say that those men that I lived with for 30 years were the finest human beings I had ever known, apart from yourselves, and I mean that quite literally. I turned out to be an alcoholic and I found out I didn't belong there. But those men who did belong there are fantastic characters. Anyway, after I was ordained a priest, as well as being a monk. Don't worry about what that difference is, don't worry. A monk is a male nun. If you could imagine such a thing. And as well as being a monk, some of them are ordained priests. And 5 years after that happened, that is in 1950, that's 5 years after the cessation of hostilities in Europe at the end of the First World War, which ended in 45, my superior took it into his head to do something with me that was to affect my life and eventually to land me right here, right now. He sent me to Rome to study all kinds of highfalutin stuff in a Roman university right under the Pope's nose. Yes. That's something that is done in the Roman Catholic Church on a regular basis. It was interrupted during the war. And the idea of it is that certain individuals who showed sort of talent and potential and all that sort of thing, were sent to those kind of places to be thoroughly brainwashed in what you might call the scholarship of Roman Catholicism and all that stuff. And in being sent to a place like that, if you kept your nose clean, you would be on the way, perhaps, towards becoming something big in the whole outfit. These are the kind of people who, when they come home and are given all kinds of various jobs, they could become a Monsignor, and then an auxiliary bishop, and then a bishop, and then an archbishop, and then a cardinal, and then... Who knows? There's never been an Irish one yet. Well, I want you to know that at this stage, this idea of loving God perfectly and becoming totally selfless and all that good stuff sort of went on a back burner. And a certain amount of egoism and careerism and ambition and all that sort of thing started taking over. Now, this was the very time when I started drinking. Ooh. I had never, up to this time, been drunk. Never. I had used about that much of wine when I would say Mass and doing my duties as a priest. Just that much. And that's all drink meant to me. But now I found myself in a monastery in Italy, in Rome, a big one. It was the headquarters of the religious order I belonged to. And there were lots and lots of monks there, but we lived in accordance with Italian ways of living. And in the middle of the monastery, there was this big, big room where all the community gathered together twice a day for the two meals that we had each day. And you always sat in the same place. There were monks there from all over the world, as well as native Italians. And you always had the same guys either side of you when you sat at the table in the big dining hall. By the way, in a monastery, the dining place is called a refectory. And you don't live in a room in a monastery. You live in a cell. Some of you may have... Well, anyway, I don't know. Well, all down the middle of these tables in this big refectory, all down the middle of these tables, there were these enormous flagons of wine. Huge, big things. And they were positioned one between each of two monks. You weren't expected to drink the whole lot. That wasn't... They were put out there the way you'd put out pitchers of water, you know, big pitchers of water. Now, the guy who sat this side of me would only take that much in the bottom of the thing. And the guy who sat this side of me, who shared the big flagon that was there with the fellow the far side of him, this guy never took any at all. He was weird. Very weird. And the guy the far side of him only took that much. So I found myself twice a day with two enormous flagons of wine literally within arm's reach. I'd never found myself in that situation in my life before. Well, anyway, I have to tell you, at each meal, I got smashed. And it was glorious. It was fantastic. I love to remember this part of my story. I love it. No one had ever told me in my entire life what happens when you get drunk. Oh boy, what a feeling. By the way, the monks would eat, you see, at their meals in total silence. And when I got drunk, the silence was shattered. God, it was marvelous. Everything was funny, funny, funny. And they'd dig me in the ribs. At the end of each meal, I had to get out around the table and stand in a straight line along with the rest of them to say the prayers, and then we had to all walk out in a straight line. It was a hell of a problem. Tacking against the wind all the time. They were glorious days. Glorious, glorious. I want to tell you, I was 3 years in that monastery, supposed to be going to the university, studying highfalutin stuff. I remember very little about it. I was definitely smashed twice a day. There was siesta after the meal in the middle of the day. There was siesta. And I slept it off at siesta. Then there was the evening meal, and I went to bed blind drunk after that. But as well as all that, I want to tell you, there were monks there, as I told you, young ones like myself, as I was then. I was a young priest. And there were guys there from America, from Australia, English-speaking ones. And we all clubbed together and formed a little clique of our, a little community of our own within the big community. They were all talking Italian and Spanish, and I couldn't tell you. Absolutely, nobody could understand them. So we clubbed together, and we had money sent to us by our bosses back home to buy books for our study and to do deep research and all that sort of thing. And we didn't need all the money we had for that purpose, you see. So we laid in what was necessary for cheering ourselves up. We were far from home, don't you know? Very far from home. And they made my cell the bar. They laid in oodles of boodle. And I had shelves in my cell, discreetly covered with a blanket, with rows and rows of bottles of bottles. And we co-opted one single young Italian monk into our circle. Just one. His father owned a winery outside of Rome. And I lived to see the day when we got a whole barrel of wine up the back stairs and along the hallway and into my cell. And there it was all set up with a faucet on it. Whole barrel. As well as the stuff on the shelves. I want to tell you, my honeymoon with booze was really something. I was 3 years in that monastery. I can honestly say, I think anyway, I was not sober one day. Really. It was fantastic. I hardly ever went out, apart from going to school. There are over 400 churches in Rome. I did not stand in more than four of them in 3 years. I saw St. Peter's. You've all heard of St. Peter's, you know, the central, big church and headquarters of Roman Catholicism with the big dome on it. I saw it from a distance once or twice. And I thought it was a carousel. It was definitely going around there. Wonderful. Those were my honeymoon years. Eventually, I got whatever degrees they sent me out there to get, and I came home, and now home means the monastery I lived in England. And I was appointed to be a professor of theology, a brilliant man, and I started teaching, and I made a discovery. I discovered that I couldn't function at all without you know what. Just couldn't function without it. And then a period in my life began when I became a closet drinker. I always had my bottle. I always had my own supply secretly consigned in my possession. Now, if you want to know from me how in the world a monk living in a monastery with his comings and goings entirely under the behest of an authority, you want to know where you were going if you were going out, he has no money, how in the heck does a guy in that kind of a situation have his own private supply of booze constantly? And all I can tell you is, I learned to live a day at a time long before I ever met you. It works. God takes care of everything. Well, I should tell you, you see, these monks that I belong to, they did go out on a regular basis to what you call the outside world to do the kind of work that they were commissioned to do. The kind of work that these kind of monks did was this. You know how it is with the Catholic churches that are in the cities and towns all around the place, with the priests that take care of those churches out there in the parishes. Now, those kind of priests taking care of the parishes, way back in those days I'm talking about, would apply to a monastery like the monastery I lived in for one or two or three of those monks to come to his parish for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks to preach what was called parish missions. And in those days, the Catholic people would crowd into the churches every night for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever. And these holy men, holy, holy monks, who had been wrapped up with God, like Moses wrapped up with God on Mount Sinai in meditation and contemplation. Moses would come down from the mountains, down to the people in the plains, to speak God's mind to them. These monks would come from the monasteries to the churches in the parishes to speak God's mind and all that stuff. And I would be sent on those kind of jobs. And as well as that, I'd be sent to give what's called retreats to nuns and convents and other kinds of people like that, all the year round. So I always was out there, on the job out there, and the pastor or the reverend mother of the convent would see that the Holy Father liked to be full of the Spirit, don't you understand? And people would notice it too. And of course they all realized if you want to really get God on your side, then you got to be good to the man of God, don't you understand? And they knew how to be good to the man of God. And I never went back to my monastery without having a couple of bottles in my bag, and maybe a case, or a backhander to be able to buy myself some. And I'm afraid that the things that I had promised not to do by my vows, I had started doing them all. For 25 years, I was a drinking alcoholic and at the same time, a hypocrite and a phony and a bum. It's a terrible part of my life that it's not pleasant to look at and to share with you. All I want you to know is that I'm a son of Adam, like anyone else is a son of Adam. When that stuff got into my bloodstream, it was no longer making me feel hilarious. I reached the stage where I was only drinking to try to feel normal, not to feel depressed, frustrated. And when that stuff got into my bloodstream, it whipped up all kinds of things inside me. Frightful, frightful bad temper. The promises I made to God about not having anything to do with sex and all that nice side of life were not kept. And I sought the kind of sleazy company and substitution kind of stuff that makes me perspire even now when I think of it. And makes me hope that, well, my mother will never find out about it. After I'd been teaching, not for a very long time, the superior of the monastery sent for me one fine day, and he said, I went into his office. I didn't like the look on his face when I did. And he looked at me and he said, the worst day's work I ever did was send you to Rome. All it did for you was, it made you an alcoholic. That was the first time in my life that filthy word was ever used to me about me. And I was appalled. I was appalled. I couldn't believe my ears, really. And he said, I want you to understand that at this moment, your teaching assignment is terminated. And I will see to it that you will never again occupy a chair of theology or a chair of scripture or philosophy or anything else anywhere in the Roman Catholic Church. I will see to that. You are a disgrace and a scandal to both young and old alike. I staggered out of there, and some of my colleagues were outside in the hallway, and I have a clear recall of my saying to them, you won't believe what that jackass has just said to me. And when I told them, they did believe it. I was reduced in the ranks, and I was required to do nothing else but the ordinary chores, like I told you about going out and giving missions and giving retreats to religious sisters and people like that. The ordinary chores that I considered you need no brains whatever for doing is all that I was entrusted with. And I became your typical obnoxious, arrogant, resentful, hate-filled, spiteful, jealous, frustrated, desperately, desperately angry, alcoholic. To make a long story short, I got the special permission of the Pope to have my vows annulled. That allowed me to be free, not to be a monk anymore, but I had to remain a priest. And when an Irishman takes a geographic, short measures availed us nothing. Half measures. I got the Bishop of San Diego, and I pulled strings and practiced all kinds of deceit to bring this about, to accept me as a priest in his diocese, San Diego, as an ordinary priest, no longer a monk, no longer, just an ordinary priest helping in the work of running a parish. And I arrived out here 1968, 20 years ago, brought my problem with me, and I was, to use the understatement of all time, an unhappy, discontented man. But I was going to start all over again, and I was going to show them out here in California what a brilliant, scholarly, highly educated man can do to put everything right with the Catholic Church in America that needed putting right. I was the one that was going to do that. I was appointed as my first assignment to a pastor who was another Irishman, an Irish pastor who was older than myself, to be his assistant. And his very first words to me, I'll never forget it, were, "Will you drink with me?" He was a consummate chronic alcoholic. And I did drink with him. And I want to tell you, in case you don't know, when two Irish alcoholics get drunk together, watch out. Keep out of the line of fire. It's very, very dangerous. It is always very dangerous. They don't talk about us being the fighting Irish for nothing. In that particular rectory I lived in as my first assignment, the police had to be called one night. I'll never forget it. I can still see the red light blinking outside. I was reassigned. And that was the story of my life for 7 more years here in California. A bungling, stumbling, unpleasant, cantankerous, miserable person. A very troubled person and making trouble everywhere I went. I want you to know that anything remotely approximating to prayer had gone out of my life completely. You can't pray and be drunk at the same time. And you can't pray when you have a hangover. And it was either one or the other that I was experiencing. I became very withdrawn. I would sit in my room with my bottle. I would feel very lonely, unappreciated, depressed. Sometimes someone would come knocking at the door to know, was I all right? And I would bawl at them to get the hell out of there. That's the beautiful manner of an alcoholic. He's miserable because he's alone, and he's miserable because anybody is trying to get to talk to him. That went on for 7 years, and in the course of those 7 years, I became friendly with one family in San Diego. This family, I always chose my friends very, very carefully. the wife of this family belonged herself to a family which owned, once again, a winery. And any time I ever visited with the family, they always gave me you-know-what to take back with me in my car. I was never without my supply. And this family went on a vacation down to Mexico. By the way, I'm going to tell you how I bottomed out. And if there's anyone here who needs to bottom out, I'll tell you exactly where to go. Not Tijuana. Keep going. Ensenada. There's the place. This family had a trailer, a big trailer. It was really two or three trailers broken into one on the beach in Ensenada. I went along with them for a vacation. They invited me. And towards the end of the vacation, the mother of the family, the wife, developed tennis elbow and she had to be brought back up to San Diego to the doctor. And that left Uncle Bill with the kids. And the kids ranged in age from Matt, who was a college age, right down to a little nipper called Timmy, a little. And on this particular night, I remember, I'd been drinking all day as usual, and I upended my bottle into the glass and threw away the empty bottle, and it's time now to go to bed. And there was a jazz band playing on the radio, and I said, now listen guys, let's get that turned off and let's all go to our beds and have peace and quiet. And they did, they turned it off, and I got up out of my chair and I was going over to the corner of the trailer where my little bunk was, and Matt, the eldest son, was standing in my way with his thumbs in his belt, looking at me very hostile. And he said to me, where are you going? Where do you think you're going? I said, I'm going to bed. Where else? He said, you're not. Not with that. And he pointed to the tumbler of whiskey in my hand, the most important one, the one I was going to pass out with. I said, who said I'm not? He said, I did. And I'm going to say more that needs to be said around here. You shouldn't drink at all, because all you are is an ignorant, savage, Irish alcoholic. Did you hear that dirty word? The second time in 25 years that dirty word was thrown into my teeth, and this time by a young punk talking to me like... Did I tell you I'm a very brilliant man? A very competent man. Highly talented and... Did I tell you? Do you hear what this joker... Do you hear what this pup is saying to me? And I said, I'm going to tell you something else. You come around here on a regular basis, freeloading off of my parents, getting your booze unlimited and unpaid for. You think you have some kind of God-given right to this, because of that bloody collar you wear back to front around your neck. Well, I've news for you. You're not welcome around here. And the sooner you realize it, the better. You make yourself scarce and get lost for good, the better we're all going to be pleased. Because you're just a drunken bum. Did I tell you I was a very brilliant man? I couldn't believe my ears. And he made a grab at the glass of whiskey in my hand, and he knocked it clean out of my hand to the last whiskey in the house. And when that happened, something happened inside me, right under my chest bone here, right in here. There was a kind of a nuclear explosion. Just pure undiluted fury burst up through me. I was just swept off my feet. I'll never forget this feeling. Totally uncontrollable rage. And all I saw was that young brat. And I wanted to get my hands around his throat and squeeze. And I wanted to see the eyes bulge out of his head. I did. I'll never forget it. Pure and diluted rage. And I went for him, for the juggler. And the rest of them who were there, the rest of the kids, God, you never heard anything like the squawking and bawling. They dragged me off of him. And I half wrecked that trailer that night. And I stormed out of there. And I knew there was a bar still open up the beach. And I went up there. And I bought a bottle, no less. My last ever drink, I prayed to God. And I stayed out on the beach till I passed out with that last bottle of booze. Do you know what my last drink was? Tequila. We'll go to any lengths. I woke up when the sun was up, and I stood up. I stayed out all night, and I stood up off the sand on the beach, and I remember looking out at that ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and it all came back to me. I had no blackout. Every bit of what had happened that night came back to me clearly. And as I looked out at the waves, I remembered the first time I had ever seen waves on the sea. It was when I got into that little ship to sail across to England all those years ago when I left home. And as I looked at the waves now in the Pacific Ocean down in Ensenada, I said to myself out loud, "You have come a long way, baby. Oh boy, you've come a long, long way. My God, you left home all those years ago wanting to get close to God, to love God, wanting to experience God's love of you, wanting to become an instrument perhaps in his hands for helping people. And my God Almighty, last night you wanted to murder somebody. You really did. You wanted to kill someone. How is it going to end? Here you are. All because of booze, booze, booze." And I had a recall of all the messes I'd gotten myself into because of booze. All the pain I had piled on myself. All the loss I had experienced in life. Booze, booze, booze every time. All the times I had said to myself, "I've got to quit, I must quit, I must quit." And as I was standing there, the cold sweat burst out on me. I recall it very well. I remember saying to myself, "Hey buddy, don't kid yourself. You're not going to quit this time no more than any other time. You're caught. You go on drinking, and you will be killed, or you will kill someone someday with a temper like yours and the positions you get yourself into. So, what you going to do? You can't live without it, and you're not going to go on living with it. What you going to do?" I shook all over. I saw a ghost. I never felt that feeling in my whole life before. Helplessness. Trapped. It was like being at the bottom of a deep, deep, muddy, slimy pit. And no way of climbing out of it. I could see the trailer down the beach. And I watched till the kids left it. I was too proud and too embarrassed to go back and apologize or anything like that. I had my own car with me, and when they were gone out of the trailer, I went in there and I got my belongings together and I dumped them into my car. And I came back up to San Diego. And the vacation was due to be wound up anyway. And I had an assignment that I had to get moving on at the end of my vacation. I had to come up here to Los Angeles to do a preaching job I was scheduled to do. And I wanted to do something that a lot of Roman Catholics coming from my religious background want to do when they're in an absolute panic. I wanted to go to confession. A thing I hadn't done for a long, long time. I wanted to do something that was a way of saying, God, God, come to me, help me, save me, I'm done. I wanted somehow to get rid of the horrible, horrible stuff that I was filled with for years. So I came up here to San Diego, to the Los Angeles area. I didn't want to go to confession to anyone who would know me down where I belonged. And I had the directory of the Los Angeles Catholic clergy, and I looked down, I was looking at addresses. I wanted to find an address that I would be able to find easily from off the freeway. I told you how easily I get lost. And I picked on an address. The name meant nothing whatever to me. I knew nobody up here. And it worked out. I got the off-ramp for this address and got to it without any trouble. And I found myself ringing this doorbell of this small little rectory. And this old guy, old priest, answered the door. And he had a very, very drawn, lined face, like parchment. And big, thick glasses, I remember, that distorted his eyes. And I said to him, I was in my clerics again. I said, Father, I said, would you hear my confession, please? Oh, he said, sure, Father, come right in. So he walked in and he sat down in his armchair and I knelt down at his side. And I was shaking all over and stinking to high heaven and sweating like a horse. And I started in to tell him as much as I could remember. And it was only a tiny fraction of what there was to be told. It was awful stuff. Horrible. Utterly, utterly horrible. I had behaved like a pig in all kinds of ways. And I finished. And he had his elbow on the arm of the armchair where I was kneeling. And he looked at me with an awful bored look on his face. And he said, what brought you to me here with all this heap of junk, he said. And I thought that was an awful strange thing to say. I said, I've come to get God's forgiveness for my sins. What the hell else? Oh, he said, I know, he said, but why did you pick on me? I said, because you don't know me, I hope. Oh, he didn't worry, he said, no, I don't. And I don't want to. But he said, I know an awful lot about you that you don't know. I know an awful lot. I know all there's to know about you, in fact. That's worth knowing. I know exactly what's wrong with you. All that's wrong with you is that you're an alcoholic and you don't like hearing it. But that's what you are. And that's the explanation of everything else. Everything else. You think it's a terrible thing to be an alcoholic and that's why you react the way you do when you're told. He said, all it means is that you have a disease that you're not responsible for having. You're allergic to this drug, alcohol, and it's got into you and has affected your brain and has programmed you to think all kinds of shit. And while you're thinking shit, it programs you to think you're thinking the greatest wisdom. Programs you to be self-destructive in every way there's to be self-destructive. Starting with destroying your own good opinion of yourself. You do every single thing that's going to make you think less of yourself and things, and you do it quite successfully. You're programmed to. That's the meaning of being an alcoholic. You're programmed to carry on in every single way that you've carried on. You're like a puppet on a string because of what that stuff is doing to your brain, your emotions, your nervous system, and the whole outfit. He said, to commit a sin, as you ought to know. You have to be a mature, responsible human being. So you needn't worry. It's been a long, long time since you have ever had any reason for worrying. And the whole time he was talking to me, I was kneeling there, and I was saying to myself, my God, what have I got myself into now? Are there two lunatics in this room or only one? And if one, which? You know, I love that part in the chapter 5, it tells us, we stood at the turning point. I knelt at the turning point. I didn't know what to think. One minute I wanted to stand up and close my fist and let him have it right in the teeth and tell him, look here, buddy, I came in here in dreadful, serious sin. Frightful sin. If I died in this condition, I'd be buried forever by God in hellfire. And don't you treat me in your offhand way and give me this goddamn chloroform. I didn't know whether to let him have that or kneel down, stay there and listen to what he was saying. And I remember saying, I wonder, am I hearing what I've always needed to hear? I wonder. And I was scared stiff to believe what he was telling me. Terribly scared. And then he said something that really clinched it. I had told him that I had picked on him by a fluke. There was no design behind it. He said, you think you came here by some kind of fluke? I have news for you, he said. You didn't come here by any fluke. You were brought here. Brought here by the scruff of the neck. I'm certain of it. And what makes me certain is this. I am an alcoholic. In an outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm the only priest for God knows how many miles around here who's in AA. And if you think you came here by a fluke, you're even stupider than you look. And then he went on to tell me all about AA. You know, when Roman Catholics go to confession, they get a penance, certain prayers to say or whatever, or things to do. Nobody, he said, for your penance, you're not going to get 3 Hail Marys or 3 rosaries for this lot. For your penance, you get your ass to an AA meeting. And I did. He brought me. And I've been here ever since. Ever since. And the last 13 years of my life have, beyond all possible question, been the most fantastic years imaginable. They really have. I wish I could give you some sort of insight into what you have done for me. They shipped me off to a treatment place, and I came home from the treatment place eventually. And when I did, I got myself a sponsor, like they told me. And my first sponsor was a guy called Richard. He had flaming red hair and a red beard, and he had absolutely no religion. None. But I had heard his story, and he had been a man with a violent temper. He had spent time in a penitentiary. He had actually taken human life. And he had knocked the brains out of people. Literally, like you'd break eggs. And now when I knew him, he was just radiating serenity. God, I envied that guy like you wouldn't believe. And I remember when I asked him to be my sponsor, he looked at me. He said, "You must be out of your mind." I said, "Of course I am." "That's why I'm asking you to be my sponsor." He said, "Aren't you the Roman Catholic?" "Yes," I said, "I am. But don't hold that against me. I'm an alcoholic. Period." And he said, "Well, okay." He said, "If I'm to be your sponsor, it'll be on my terms." "Of course," I said. He said, "Why do you pick on me, I'd like to know?" Same old question. "Because," I said, you had one hell of a temper, and you don't seem to have one now, and I would give my right arm off to be like that. I really would. That's all I want. A thing called peacefulness, serenity. God, how do you do it?" "Okay," he said, "okay. But you do exactly what I tell you." So I was to phone him twice a day. I was to tell him what was going on outside of me and inside of me. And I'll tell you what to think about all that. He said, "And you think it." "Go to meetings, read a big book, blah, blah, blah." Time went on. He said to me eventually, "Well, have you read the big book?" I said, "Yes." "All of it?" "Yes, up to the stories." "Did you read the chapter, The Agnostic?" "Ah," I said. "You know the job I'm in, Peter." "Richard, did you read the chapter?" "No," I said. "Well, read the thing," he said. And I did. And I want to tell you guys and gals, and I mean every syllable of this, and it's all I've come here to tell you, really. There is no single piece of literature on this planet known to me more precious, more fantastic than that chapter to the agnostic in the book called Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book. Nowhere. I spent 30 years in a monastery. I spent 3 years in a university in Rome, studying all kinds of spirituality, and I couldn't tell you what all. Nothing I have ever read, or ever read since, comes within a billion miles of what's in that chapter. It's fantastic. But my sponsor told me how to read it and how not to read it. He said, when you open that chapter, a smart ass like you is going to be saying to yourself, "Oh, I know what they're going to do. They're going to try to prove to me now that there's a God, and I don't need that. But anyway, that's what they're going to try to do, prove that there's a God." He said, "That's not what that chapter is trying to do at all. But as long as you think that that's what it's trying to do, you won't even see what it's trying to do, let alone let it do it for you. It is not trying to prove to you that there's a God. It's trying to do something much more fantastic. It's trying to get you to make a certain little adjustment which will make it possible for God to prove to you that there is a God. And that's something totally different." He said to me, "If you want to make it in this program, you've got to get rid of all your old ideas first. Every idea was ever put into your head in that little village that you came from in Ireland by the nuns and the priests and the religious brothers. Every idea that was put into your head by the people who taught you in the monastery and the monks that shared with you in the monastery. Every idea was put into your head in a Roman university. Get rid of them all. I don't care where they came from. Get rid of them. The result will be nil until you do. Are you listening? Whatever you have come into this program with, ideas about God, ideas about right and wrong, ideas about what matters and what doesn't matter, ideas about how to live, get rid of them all. The result will be nil until you do. and sit down and listen to what we have to tell you, he said. And we have to tell you two simple things for openers. If you have come in here with some kind of God, put him on hold. Just put him on hold. And if you must have a God, settle for the one that we have found helps you get sober. He loves you. He loves you as you are. As you are. He loves you out of sight. It's not that he used to before you started messing up. It's not that he's going to when you get your act cleaned up. He loves you totally. He's mad about you. Believe that and you'll get well. Don't and you won't. Second, I am not a bad, wicked, terrible person who needs to become good. I am not. I am just a poor, poor, sick person. Disastrously, self-destructively sick, sick, sick. I cannot help myself being the way I am. Believe that and you'll get well. Don't and you won't. And then read the chapter to the agnostic. If you're one of these who wonders, what is the God at all? And look at what it's telling you. All it's telling you is, we live in a wonderful world, a mysterious world, extraordinary world. Wonderful, yes. So, wonder. That's all, wonder. See that it is wonderful and wonder. You sow a seed in the soil and flowers grow. How does that happen? I wonder. I wonder. You look at a steel girder and it looks absolutely uninteresting, and some scientists will show you what's there, a whole lot of atoms burling around, burling like mad. All these little lads in there holding up concrete buildings. Little fellas. I wonder how it all came about. I wonder. So wonder, that's all. Wonder. Maybe there is a God, which is only another way of saying maybe there isn't. Maybe there isn't is only another way of saying maybe there is. I wonder. That's all. Just wonder. And then you come to the end of the chapter. We finally came to see that faith in some kind of God might not be as irrational as we had hitherto supposed, but how to make the transition from maybe there is to I know there is. How do you make that transition? We had to search fearlessly. Does that remind you of any step Richard said to me? Oh yes, I said, the fourth step. Brilliant, he said, brilliant. Keep coming back. We had to search fearlessly. Where? We found the great reality deep down within our own selves. There's where you search, fearlessly. Deep down within your own selves. In the last analysis, it is only there he can be found. And when found, he was as much a fact as we ourselves were. Listen to those sentences, they're like sledgehammers. I'm pretty sure that I'm a fact, that I didn't dream myself up. Sometimes I've doubts about you. I'm pretty sure that I'm a fact. And here's this big book telling me that I can be as sure God is a fact as I am that I am a fact myself. That's pretty sure. How do you get to be that sure? Take your fourth step, that's how. And when you do, among other things, notice what you're doing. You're getting in touch with those areas where you experience your own powerlessness. My powerlessness to accept my lot in life, to enjoy it and not just endure it. My powerlessness to do that. My powerlessness over my resentments, my hates, my spites. My powerlessness over my lust. My powerlessness over my pride, my avarice, my ambitions. my longing for recognition, my powerlessness in a million areas. And now what do I do with it all? I have to put it all out there on a place and say, are you there? Please, are you there? I want you to be. I don't want my life to be a little closed-in universe with no God in it. I don't want that. Are you there? I want to be empowered to do what I'm powerless to do myself. Be an accepting person instead of a resenting person. I want to be empowered to be a selfless person instead of a self-centered person. I want that. I don't want to be this kind of a bastard that I know I am and can't help myself being. Please, please, empower me to be what I'm powerless to be. Empower me to stop being what I'm powerless to stop being. And then live your life a day at a time, figuring what a good God would want you to do if there were such a thing, and do it. And a fantastic thing is going to happen unless millions of AAs are lying to us. You're going to find yourself being empowered to be this different kind of person you have always wanted to be. You're going to find yourself being empowered to stop being this self-destructive, obnoxious, proud, avaricious, sensual bastard you can't stop yourself being. And when you find yourself empowered to be what you're powerless to be, then you know there's a power greater than yourself. Big deal. There's no other way for knowing it. There is no other way. There never was, there never will be. This business of finding this power that's greater than ourselves is not a head trip. The church people all think that. It is not a head trip. I used to think it was. So I set out to be a doctor of theology to know how to do it. And look what I became. It is not a head trip. It is something you find out. When I was a little child, how did I find out that my mother loved me? Did I sit down with pencil and paper and work out an abstruse argument ending up, therefore she loves me? The hell I did. I came in from the backyard all dirty and disheveled and cut, clothes torn, had been in a fight, of course. And I came in the back door, and there was my poor mother in the kitchen. Oh, child, what have you been doing to yourself? And she'd take me up in her arms, and she'd clean me and comb my hair and put new clean clothes on me and make me feel lovely and silky and satiny and innocent again. She made me feel good. She cleaned up my mess and made me feel good. That's how we find out in our outfit that there is someone who can clean up our mess and make us feel good. Therefore, he, she, it loves us. He introduces himself to you. There is no other way. I told you that I set out in my little life wanting to get close to God, wanting to become a saint, wanting to have him make me into something worth being. I came to you. Do you know the people in this fellowship that I identify with most of all? I identify with people who have been involved in a marriage that began as a happy, happy marriage. And booze got in there, and rows, and mess, and all the usual. And it broke up. And someone was stumbling through life, alone, heartbroken, no one or nobody to blame but their own selves. And yet, longing it mightn't have been so. I was that way for 25 years. I know how it feels. I know how it feels. And what am I to say to people that I have found who gave me back what I thought I had lost, gave it to me back in such a way that I can enjoy it now in a way I could never have enjoyed it before? I have a happy life today. I'll tell you something. When you were in my job, a priest, it's very nice to know that there's a God. But it makes the job a bit more interesting, a bit easier. It's very nice to know. You have given me all I have ever wanted in life. You have filled me with all I have ever wanted. And it gets better every day. I want to say to you this morning, and it's all I want to say to you, thank you for giving me God, and I thank God for giving me you. I love you all. Thank you.